You're about to listen to an interview to Donald Ferenc, who is the convener of the Global Institute for the Prevention of Aggression, a research associate at the Center for Criminology of the Oxford University Faculty of Law, and a visiting professor at Middlesex University School of Law in London. Don is a specialist on the crime of aggression. For those in the audience not familiar with it, the crime of aggression is one of the four core crimes, together with crimes against humanity, genocide, and war crimes, set out in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. It was prosecuted by the Nuremberg Tribunal under the category of crimes against peace. This interview was conducted by myself, Antonia Macias. I'm a lawyer, executive director of Equipo NISCOR, and a program coordinator for Radio NISCOR. Good morning, Donald. We are here at The Hague today, participating and attending the 17th Assembly of State Parties to the International Criminal Court, and Radio NISCOR would like for you to explain what is the crime of aggression and what's at stake right now.
Thank you very much, Antonia. I'd like to begin by saying a little bit in terms of the background of the history of the crime of aggression, as well as a few words about my own history. I was born in Nuremberg, Germany, in 1952. I was born there because my father, Benjamin Ferenc, had been a prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials, which were put on by the Americans, subsequent to the International Military Tribunal. He had been the chief prosecutor in what became known as the Einsatzgruppen case. The Einsatzgruppen were special death squads which came in behind the German advancing lines in Eastern Europe and killed every Jew, every gypsy, every communist, every undesirable they could get their hands on. I mention it because my father opened his case by saying very poignant words which are still true today. He said, "The case we present is a plea of humanity to law." Today, we have a Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, and recently it has activated amendments which will criminalize what is now called the crime of aggression, the illegal use of force by states. These amendments require ratification by countries around the world before they can become truly operative. They require broad ratification. And where my father began his case by saying the case we present is a plea of humanity to law, today we have an ironic turning of the tables, so to speak. Today we have a plea not of humanity to law. We have a plea of law to humanity. We have the law. We have the Rome Statute. We have the amendments which clearly define the crime of aggression and the conditions under which the court can exercise its jurisdiction. And that law is crying out to our humanity to get behind that law and to ratify it. So that's where we are today in a nutshell. But let's go back and talk about what is the crime of aggression and where did it come from in law. I want to start very early on. I want to start at what I consider to be a beginning point in the discussion of what is law all about. Some of you will have heard of the ancient code of Hammurabi. Hammurabi was a Babylonian king who lived about 1800 years before Christ. We know about Hammurabi's code today because he had it etched on stone. And the stone exists today and can be seen in the Louvre Museum in Paris. It's a rather archaic code, and I won't go into it, other than to say that its preamble is very interesting. Hammurabi explains why he's giving the law. Among other things, he says, effectively, "I'm giving this law so that the powerful shall not harm the weak." This is what law is all about. Law is an equalizer among those of disparate positions of power in society, whether that be domestic society or global society. So I like to begin there to get our minds focused on what is law really about? What is it intended to do? It's intended to make life livable so people can come out of what Thomas Hobbes, the philosopher, described as the state of nature and live like civilized people together, again, whether it be in domestic or in global societies of peace. Now, there's another ancient voice that I like to talk about, and that is Thucydides. Thucydides was the chronicler of the ancient Peloponnesian Wars. He was a very pragmatic thinker. And he said words that have echoed through the ages. He said, "The strong do what they can, and the weak endure what they must." That's true in a lawless society. That's the reason we have law, so that the powerful cannot simply do what they want to do, and the weak do not simply have to endure what is inflicted on them by those in positions of power. This is why we have law, not only to protect the weak from the powerful, but to protect the powerful from themselves. So I'm going to jump ahead now. We have a different ethos today, which is epitomized in four words etched in stone also over the portico of the United States Supreme Court. I'm an American, so I'm sensitive to this. There are four words etched in stone over the U.S. Supreme Court, which in four simple words give the message of what we idealize as the ideal to which we aspire today. The four words are equal justice under law. Equal justice, not simply for the rich and for the powerful, but for everyone in society. And we all know if law is not equally applied, it certainly doesn't smell like justice to anybody. Sometimes I say that, and it's true, sadly, that there are those who have forgotten the ethos of liberty and justice for all, and in their minds have replaced it with an ethos that says liberty and just us for all. So, okay, that's a little bit of a theoretical background about what is law supposed to do. At the end of the horrific World War I, in the process of putting together the Treaty of Versailles, a commission was organized to look at the causes and responsibilities of the war. And they had a very interesting preliminary report in which they wrote, going to war itself is not illegal. And there was an effort after World War I to try the German Kaiser, Wilhelm II, for a crime which essentially had never been tried before in international law. He was not being tried for the crime of aggression. He was being tried for the violation of the sanctity of treaties and so forth. He fled to the Netherlands and he was never tried. There were some trials, sometimes referred to as the Leipzig trials, where the German government was supposed to try war criminals. They were very ineffective. And so that was what we had at the end of World War I. In the interwar years, we had a lot of efforts to create peace. There was a French general who, upon the signing of the Versailles Treaty, said, "This is not really a peace treaty." He said, "This is a 20-year truce." And he was very far-sighted in his thinking because 20 years later, 1939, we had the outbreak of World War II. But in the intervening years, we had something called the Kellogg-Briand Pact. Aristide Briand, French foreign minister, reached out to the not only the American State Department, but the American people. He did something actually quite outrageous. He didn't knock on the door of the State Department and say, "I have an agreement I'd like to enter into with the United States." He wrote an open letter to the American people, inviting them to a perpetual friendship agreement. The people in the State Department were furious. Frank Kellogg, who was the head of the Department of State at the time, was livid when he saw this. And they didn't even respond for several months. Finally, they said, "We're not going to have a treaty just with France because we don't want to be in a bilateral arrangement which may drag us into the next French war." They said, "Let's open this for signature to the entire world, a treaty for the renunciation of war as an instrument of national policy." And everybody was very happy with that treaty in 1928 and 1929. Most of the major countries of the world signed it, and it looked like things were going to be rosy. But there was a person in the U.S. Senate, and you've heard me speak about this, Antonio, before, so I'll share this with your listeners. His name was John James Blaine, Republican senator from Wisconsin. He was the only person in the United States Senate who voted against the ratification of the Kellogg-Briand Pact. When I began to research what raving madman would vote against this treaty to renounce war, I found that he recognized that the treaty had no provisions for sanction, it had no criminal provisions, and worse, he knew that the British, the French, and the Americans had effectively reserved for themselves the right to go to war anywhere in the world that they, in their sole discretion, felt that their interests required defending. No judicial arbitration, nothing of that sort. And so he voted against it, and he said, "Weighted down by the reservations, the treaty contains the fertile soil for all the wars of the future." He went on to say, I don't know when it's coming, but this treaty portends an early conflict. The first one, he said, will be a commercial war, and the second one, he said, could only be imagined in its as to its magnitude in the infinite mind. This was 1929, January 9th, 1929, when he made these remarks on the floor of the U.S. Senate. And, of course, within a few years, the war that he predicted had come. After World War II, the Germans were tried for what was called crimes against peace, which included basically going to war, aggressive war, in violation of international treaties and assurances. And there was quite a question as to whether or not this was ex post facto law, meaning law that was put in place after the acts which were criminalized had been committed, which is a violation of a principle, a fundamental principle of law. So notwithstanding that argument, the Nuremberg judgment held that the Germans had gone to war in violation of the Kellogg-Briand Pact and other principles of international law, which they felt had criminalized law to the point where no one should say they were surprised to be held legally accountable on a personal basis. Today, we have a situation where all these years after Nuremberg, the International Criminal Court has now, effective as of July 17, 2018, finally been able to activate its own jurisdiction over something referred to as simply the crime of aggression, which includes serious acts in violation of the UN Charter by countries against the sovereignty, territorial independence of other countries. And it includes a litany of things, bombardment, blockade, occupation, annexation, and this sort of thing. So people can look that up if they want to on the internet. They can go to the website of the International Criminal Court and they can read the statute for themselves. But the biggest issue today that is confronting the world as to who, if anyone, will be held accountable is this. The crime is what's called a leadership crime. And there's a reason why it's a leadership crime, because it's the leaders of countries who are most responsible for taking their nations into war. One of the defendants at Nuremberg who was sentenced to death, sentenced to be hung by the neck until dead, was Wilhelm Goering, who was former Reich Marshal, and he felt it was very undignified to have to be sentenced to be killed in a way that a common criminal would be killed. He wanted an execution by firing squad, military firing squad. He actually took his own life on the eve of his intended execution, with a cyanide capsule. But he made some very interesting remarks in his prison cell in Nuremberg in April of 1946, well before his intended execution, talking about how easy it is to drag any nation into war. And basically what he said, and this is almost an exact quote, was he said, "Naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia nor in England, nor in America, nor for that matter in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders who make policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a parliamentary democracy or a fascist dictatorship. Voice or no voice," he said, "the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger." And then he added, "It works the same way in any country." End of quote. So that's the world we live in. As an American who saw his country dragged into a war in Iraq in 2003 under false pretenses of so-called weapons of mass destruction, I see that exact game plan was put in place by the United States and Great Britain as well, which connived, their leaders connived together to put together a story they could sell to the American, British public, and the rest of the world. We know from the Chilcot Report it was a total subterfuge. Now, today we have 36 countries that have already ratified the amendments criminalizing aggression and applying it effectively to their own national leaders. Germany is among them. The Netherlands is among them, and a whole host of smaller countries, but half of the NATO, over half of the members of NATO have ratified this. Italy is this week debating this in their parliament to adopt, and I think that they will adopt. But who has not adopted? The French and the British are both member states of the Assemblies of States parties. They are both permanent members on the Security Council, and neither one of them has come forward to ratify on the crime of aggression. I was quoted in the Guardian newspaper about a year or so ago saying that you would think that of all people, the nations which sat in judgment at Nuremberg would be embarrassed, if not ashamed, by the utter hypocrisy of failing to lead by example on the crime of aggression. They criminalized it against the Germans, and now when it is time for them to say, yes, this law applies to us as well, they have put their hands in their pockets and done nothing. It is time for them to come forward and play a leadership role, as they should. And there's another reason they should play a leadership role. Britain and France are among the countries which have ratified the Rome Statute and domesticated the core crimes, which means that if you are a British or French soldier, for example, man or woman, who's asked to go out and fight and possibly even die for your country, you can be prosecuted for the crime of war crimes, which is a much lesser crime than the crime of aggression, which was dubbed at Nuremberg as the supreme international crime. Now, here's the point that I want to make. There is a level of several levels of hypocrisy relating to a failure of the major players like England, rather the United Kingdom, I should say, and France, who have not taken a leadership role on the crime of aggression. One is, it's embarrassing that those who sat in judgment at Nuremberg have done nothing to advance the crime of aggression as applied to themselves. And as an aside, I would mention that at Nuremberg, one of the strongest voices for the universalization of the Nuremberg principles was the American chief prosecutor, Robert Jackson, who made it very plain in his statements before the court that although these standards are first being applied against German Nazi aggression, if they are to mean anything, statesmen must be held accountable to law in the future, including those nations, he said, which, quote, sit here now in judgment. So he was very, very far-sighted in trying to not simply apply victor's justice against the defeated, but create a rule of law that would apply even to the victors in the future and to put even future victorious powers on notice that they too will be held accountable for violations of international law. So that's one level of hypocrisy. And the other one is this. Soldiers of countries which have ratified the Rome Statute and have domesticated the crimes of war crimes and crimes against humanity, they can be prosecuted in a court of law in their own country for having committed a violation, by example, let's say a war crime, killing civilians in a time of war. And of course, these things do happen, tragically. The irony is, and the hypocrisy is, that if those nations have not domesticated the crime of aggression into their own jurisdiction, the foot soldiers who go out to risk their lives to fight and die for a country can be held accountable in a court of law. But those politicians who send them to fight and die in violation of what Nuremberg dubbed the supreme international crime themselves go scot-free with no accountability, no criminal accountability whatsoever. That hypocrisy and that double standard is something that every mother and every father whose son or daughter is being sent out to fight and die should object to. And I think if they knew it, they would object to it, and they should scream loud and long, saying, how is it that politicians can make these decisions knowing that they are insulated from accountability when my child may be asked to die, and if they commit any breach of the laws of war, go to jail? It's just a tremendous imbalance and a tremendous double standard that should be addressed by ratification of these amendments on aggression. Now, there is just one last comment I'd like to make about what does it all mean? I know that there are countries that are object to the rule of law being applied against their nationals. I won't mention any of them specifically, but I think one has to ask a fundamental question. In the world in which we live, where arms are so prevalent, so many countries are selling so many billions and hundreds of billions of military-grade equipment all over the world, whether it be fighter jets or artillery or guns or whatever it is, automated weaponry. You've got arms in the hands of a lot of people. Now, Let me just take one example. Let's say that there is a group that feels that they have a grievance against a particular country. I'll call it Country A. And they know that Country A is not a member of the International Criminal Court, that Country A has not subjected its national leaders, its military leaders, and its other people to the rule of law as set forth in the Rome Statute. If we have a situation where Country A is perceived as being beyond the rule of law, then those who feel they have grievances against Country A can say to those who are aggrieved, we have no recourse other than force of arms against the people of Country A. We can fire rockets into Country A because Country A does not submit itself to the rule of law, international law, and therefore we have no other choice but to take the law into our own hands by force of arms. I make this point because I think if I were a citizen of a country, I would rather have an opponent in a particular controversy send a legal brief to the court rather than send a rocket over the border. And I think that's a general principle of law that we certainly apply in domestic societies. We don't allow lawless conduct without judicial enforcement. And yet in the global environment, in the international environment, we still live in a world where we do not have uniform enforcement and uniform subjugation, really, to the rule of law. It is something that I see as a necessary component of a more peaceful world. And coming back specifically to the crime of aggression, I'd like to end with another quote, ironically, from the lips of, I said Wilhelm Goering earlier. It's not Wilhelm, it was Hermann Goering. So I misspoke. It was Kaiser Wilhelm, not Wilhelm Goering, Hermann Goering, who said, war is like a football game. Whoever loses gives his opponent his hand, and everything is forgotten. If that's the world we want, countries can continue to ignore their duty to ratify the amendments on the crime of aggression. If they want a different and better world, they need to do something about it, and their people need to know about it, and they need to make some noise. So I hope that all the listeners to this broadcast will understand their responsibility to make the world they want to see. Thank you.
Thank you, Donald, for this very much needed statement against the glorification of war. Thank you, Donald. You've just listened to an interview to Donald Ferenc on the crime of aggression. For further information on the crime of aggression and the illegal use of force as a crime against humanity, you can visit the page dedicated to this topic at Equipo Niscor's website. This interview was recorded at The Hague on December the 6th and produced at our studios in Belgium on December 13th, 2018.